Okay, we're going to be discussing, again, how we got the Bible, a new lesson on that. I'm going to go through and kind of discuss the actual witnesses that exist that attest to our having the actual inspired text of God's Word, the evidence which would support, if we were to say that the Bible that we have is God's inspired Word. Someone would say, well, you know, do you have the actual letters that are written, Paul's letters? Do you have copies of his or do you have the actual letters he wrote? Well, no, we don't. Well, how do you know then that what you have is what he wrote? And there are kind of two parts to this. This is the first part, discussing the manuscripts themselves, explaining the amount of evidence that we have to establish the validity of the text, the veracity of the text. The other is what is referred to as Bible criticism, where you spend the time to explain how the copies are, in fact, legitimately accurate representations of God's Word, or accurate copies of God's Word. So that's basically what we're going to try to do in the lesson this evening, is discuss the Bible manuscripts. That happens a lot, actually. It's a function of doors opening and air conditioner turning on, that kind of stuff. So we'll start in just a few moments. I've got some very interesting things to tell you about the various manuscripts that we do have. We actually have talked about this a lot in regard to the Old Testament as a part of our study of the Dead Sea Scrolls. So I'm not going to spend a great deal of time discussing the Old Testament manuscripts. We're just going to review there, and we're going to spend the majority of our time talking about the New Testament witnesses that we have. So we'll start that in just a moment's time. Okay, first of all, I want to apologize for the size of the type in the handouts. Unfortunately, it was a little bit bigger, about the same size as the bulletin, but then I decided to add that paragraph at the end because it was a very interesting quote. Couldn't get it all on the page, so I had to make the font smaller in order to get it all in. I apologize for that. This is going to be somewhat lecture, but I don't want to preclude you from asking any questions, or if you have something to add that you're aware of that I'm passing over, or maybe some inaccuracy, then let me know about that. But again, what we're talking about are the actual manuscripts from which we get our versions of the Bible today. So what we're talking about now are the original languages. What we discussed when we talked about how we got the English Bible, is the history of the English translation from the original language. We've already mentioned that the Bible is primarily made up of, in the Old Testament, the Hebrew language, and then the New Testament, the Greek language, the Koine Greek of the New Testament, which is a kind of a version of the Greek language that was common at that time. So we talked quite a bit about the Old Testament text in our discussion of the Dead Sea Scrolls. And you may remember when we talked about the Old Testament text, we mentioned that we do not have very old copies of the Hebrew Old Testament, the Hebrew Bible. The reason for that is that the Hebrews were very, very respectful with regard to copies of the Word. So if those copies became damaged in some way, which by reason of use they would, so that they would not be misused or abused, whenever one was found to be damaged or it was beginning to get raggedy, then they would bury it. And so it would be lost to us, and that was very typical of the process. So, as a result of that, there were questions with regard to the accuracy of the text. If you're talking about the Old Testament, which ended in its inspiration 500 years before Christ was born, or well, maybe not quite that much, but in that general area, 5 centuries before the birth of Christ, and the earliest copies that you have of the Hebrew Scriptures is about close to 10 centuries after the birth of Christ. They said, well, how do you know that it's accurate? Well, there are two things that we argue with regard to the accuracy of the Old Testament. One is the care that was taken by the scribes in copying it. We talked about the Masoretic tradition and those scribes that preceded the Masoretes that were very, very careful. They had numbered every single word of any particular book. They numbered the exact number of letters in any particular book. They were able to tell you what the middle letter and the middle word was of any particular book. And as they made their copies, following some very strict guidelines, if at the end of that they were to go back and with all these safeguards find it was wrong in any way, then it could not be used as a legitimate copy of the Old Testament scriptures. And some would say, well, that still, you know, doesn't prove that what we have is an accurate representation, which is where the Dead Sea Scrolls come into play. Because you'll remember the Isaiah scroll, the primary Isaiah scroll, was a scroll that predated Christ by an extensive period of time. And when it is compared to the Masoretic text that was familiar and was the basis of the Hebrew Scriptures and our translations from them, it's found to be almost identical in just about every respect, which gives us credence to say that it has been faithfully reproduced through the years. Now, that's the Old Testament. And so the Old Testament, the witnesses that we have with regard to the Hebrew text are much later. The Dead Sea Scrolls have been a really great and wonderful find, which helps to verify the accuracy of that text. But the witnesses are by and large much older. You'll notice that there is in the third major bullet under Old Testament text, there are about four or five different codices or codexes. I think both of those plurals are acceptable, if I remember correctly, that form the basis of what is referred to as the Masoretic text. The first one is the most important one, the Aleppo Codex, that was created in the 10th century in the city of Aleppo in Syria. And it is kind of the basis for the Masoretic text today. And there are other witnesses that corroborate it. But it's a very important work. There's an interesting story behind that. About a quarter of it was destroyed in 1947. You'll remember that was the time in which the Jewish state was established, which caused a revolt among Arab populations in the region. And there was a synagogue in I think the city of Aleppo, if I remember correctly in the story, a synagogue where the codex was stored, that was burned to the ground by a mob of Arabs protesting the United Nations partitioning Palestine into the State of Israel and the Arab State of Palestine. And when that happened, a lot of unrest and bloodshed at that time. And one thing that suffered as a result of it was one of the primary witnesses of the Old Testament. A codex, by the way, is a book. When you hear the word codex, you're talking about something that's kind of like a bound volume. So the second one is the Leningrad Codex, which is the oldest complete manuscript of the Hebrew Bible. It was made in Cairo, Egypt, in about the early 11th century, and it's now in the National Library in St. Petersburg, Russia. Of course, St. Petersburg, during the time in which the Soviet Union was still in existence, was known as Leningrad. And so that's the name that is taken, the Leningrad Codex. It's now in that National Library. And these are both examples of the Masoretic text. Then the third, these are the two most important ones. The third and fourth and fifth that are mentioned here, perhaps lesser witnesses, but nevertheless important. The Cairo Codex, or Cairo Codex, excuse me, which was a copy of the prophetic books. That was a little bit earlier, but it was only of the prophetic books. And then the Leningrad Codex of the Prophets actually predated the Codex itself, the complete Codex. It includes Isaiah, Jeremiah, Ezekiel, and the Minor Prophets. And then there is a codex, a book that consists of the Pentateuch, which are the first five books of the law, five books of the Bible, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy, that it resides in the British Museum, that is likewise one that dates from about the 10th century. Okay, so that's basically from whence we get the Old Testament. And if we are to argue with regard to the accuracy of that text, the two major arguments we would raise as to that, as we acknowledge the late date of the extant manuscripts, would be the care of the scribes in transcribing copies of the text, and then the corroboration of the Dead Sea Scrolls, which again was a very important event. You think of it in the opposite way. What if the book of Isaiah and the entirety of the book of Isaiah had been found dating from, I forget now, what was the date of the Dead Sea Scrolls when that was? It was two or three centuries before Christ, it seems like, is the date that it's ascribed to it. But anyway, what if that was very different from the Masoretic text? Well, then that would have given some cause for the skeptics to say, well, we can't know what God actually wrote and what was actually a part of the Old Testament. Now, having said that, I would hasten to say that when we're talking about the New Testament witnesses, they're far more ancient and far more numerous. And it's a very interesting study with regard to the New Testament text. And that's basically where I want to spend the majority of my time this evening in talking about it. Anybody have any comments or questions about the Old Testament before we get into the New Testament?
Yes, guys? Codexes you're talking of, I'd like to know physically how they are. When you touch them, I don't mean touch them, but use the glove hands I've seen, but in the glove hands, when they fall apart, do they x-ray these?
Well, you have to be very careful. And yeah, in fact, the 10th century ones, they're not as old, and to be honest, I didn't look into the material with regard to what they were written on. We're going to talk about that in some detail with regard to the New Testament manuscripts. The earliest New Testament manuscripts written that we have in existence are papyrus fragments. Now, papyrus is basically the Egyptian version of paper. The papyrus plant is a plant that they beat on it, broke down the fibers, got it wet, molded it. As it dried, it became a form of paper. It's not made of wood like our paper is. It's made of a papyrus plant, but it's very similar to it. Very fragile. And there are, I think if you look on the back of the page, top part of the page, we have 95 papyri. And most of them would be in fragments. And yeah, you touch it, it breaks. That kind of thing. And all of these kinds of materials, I'll just give as an example the Dead Sea Scroll of the prophet Isaiah. You can go into the, it's called the something of the book. Not the building of the book, but it's a round building that's there in the Jerusalem area. The Shrine of the Book, I think is what it's called. Maybe not. That's not it either. You remember?
No.
Okay. Well, anyway, you go in, and of course, the Dead Sea Scroll of Isaiah is pretty much the preeminent archaeological find of the state of Israel. It's the most important thing. And you can go into this. It's like the Shrine of the Book or something was called. And there's a big display of that particular copy of Isaiah, and it runs across the whole wall in a kind of a circular form, takes up a big display, and it's actually, you know, in the writing and everything, it's very dark in there and dimly lit. Well, it's not even the original, it's just a copy of the original. In other words, they took pictures and they replicated it as close as they possibly could. The original's back in. And you know, once they did that, they put it up and they don't touch it. It's in a room with no humidity, with temperature at a particular constant state, no light. You know, in other words, any way they can preserve it, they do that. And that's the way it is with most of these kinds of manuscripts. It's an interesting thing. For example, when the Catholic Church the Vatican manuscript. The Catholic Church had control of the Vatican, in fact, still does. It's in the Vatican at this point in time. The Vatican manuscript is perhaps the most important New Testament witness. It is an extremely important New Testament witness. And it wasn't until, I mean, this thing, we know of its existence from the late 1400s. And the Catholic Church wouldn't let anybody look at it until the 1850s. And it wasn't until about 1890 that they were willing to utilize their abilities and their scholars to actually make copies of it so there would be an accurate copy of that original manuscript. Well, these days you can actually go on the internet and you can look at high definition pictures of every single page of those manuscripts. I think there are several that are actually open to the public, and others, if you have, you know, you have the password and you have access, you can do that. But in other words, finally today scholars have access to these things. And one of the reasons why we talked about the King James Version of the Bible did not utilize any of the three most important witnesses, even though the Vatican manuscript was in existence, known to be in existence, a couple of hundred years before James authorized the translation of the Bible, is because the Catholics wouldn't let anybody see it. You know, that was just kind of the stranglehold that Catholicism had upon the these copies at that time. So to state shortly what I should have said shortly and talk 10 minutes about is they're very fragile and very well protected, and if anybody does touch it, it's basically to catalog it, make sure that everything is the way it ought to be, and put it back. So it's, you just don't have access to it, and it's because of how fragile it is. Okay, anybody else about the Old Testament? Yes.
Do they know when the scribes quit copying the Old Testament?
They never did.
Never did quit?
No. I mean, understand this. What happened was the printing press came about. When the printing press came about, it no longer was necessary to hand copy. Up until such time as the printing press came about, everybody hand copied everything. That's the only way you could do it. So everything was hand copied up until then.
I wonder why we didn't have any copies from in the BC and to the ADs. Why they keep making copies, thing that we had.
Well, they did, but again, we don't have those copies. We only have copies of those copies. Because again, it's just, you have to understand that with regard to writing like this, it's upon a fragile medium first, whether it be papyrus or even clay. Which clay, for example, there are thousands of years old things on clay. Yeah, but most of the things written on clay was broken into pieces or eroded because of being exposed, and it was only those things that were covered up and you know, luckily or carefully preserved that we have copies of them. So that's the way it is with stone. I mean, you just think about it. You know, if anything's left exposed to the elements, what's going to happen? It's with stone, it's with clay, and then when you get into the more recent things, though they're easier to use, they're actually more fragile because you're talking about leather, you're talking about vellum, you're talking about papyrus and paper. And so, you know, the longer, I mean, how many things that you wrote when you were in your teenage years, or I wrote when I was in my teenage years, do we still have copies of? They just don't stay around.
Well, we delete them.
Now, if yeah, we'll rip them up or throw in the fire, things like that.
Email.
Yeah, well, emails, it's a little different these days.
But
having said that, you know, when they said that the first complete work that Gutenberg printed in his printed press is the Bible, the Gutenberg Bible. That's the first one he did. It's not the first thing that's printed, and the printing press, of course, was invented by the Chinese and all this good stuff. But you hear about Gutenberg and the printing press and the Gutenberg Bible. Well, it took a long time to do it. You know, you handset every single piece of type, but once you've done that, instead of making one copy, you can, you know, slam it down 50 times, and you got 50 copies of that page, and then you go on to the next, and when you compile it, you've got 50 copies. You know, so that's, once that happened, mechanical reproduction, then the idea of having such copyists and all, it went astray. But up until that time, any kind of communication was handwritten.
Right. But I was getting that, you know, I mean, with the judges and the king, the good judge, bad judge, good king, you know, and all of a sudden they would find a copy of the law, and how many years went by, but they put the temple and all that, and yeah, with Ezra and Nehemiah, and yeah. kind of wonder why they didn't continue through the ages.
For a period, the law was actually even lost. And I do think that, as Dennis alluded to at the very end of our study last time, there's something to be said for the providence of God with regard to the preservation of these things through the years, because there were times when the people of Israel cared less whether the law continued or not. And a period of time where it was kind of questionable as to whether the law had actually managed to remain in existence because of their idolatries.
It's kind of interesting to me how the book itself, validates itself in some of the most interesting ways, because there's no way that a person of that time could think of or would be compelled to think of writing these types of things into the text to make it inaccurate, but also make it so to be valid today or whatnot. Just to play tricks with the text, it doesn't work. But I'm sitting here thinking, we get this, the book that I hold in my hands today, from the text that we've been discussing with this whole class. And what I read in these texts is good enough for Jesus. I mean, how we got the text from the 8th century, the 9th century, the 10th century, it was the same way Jesus got his text. Jesus said, when he was tempted, it is written 3 times. And he quoted it verbatim. And then later, next chapter, he states, for truly I say to you, until heaven and earth pass away, not an iota, not a dot will pass from the law until all is accomplished. It's good enough for the Savior of mankind. And you can't just write those things in there unless you happen to know that this objection will come up millennia later. It doesn't make sense.
Yeah. This is definitely the discussion of this, and when we continue in with regard to the textual criticism, it's something that's certainly going to be faith-building for us. We're not going to have time to go into detail with anything, so I do want to get through this material because, again, I don't want to rush, but at the same time, I don't want to spend as much time as we would if we're, in the Bible talking about Scripture, so I do want to get the material covered as quickly as possible. I want you to note, when we're talking about the New Testament, we're talking about the Greek language now, and we're talking about, again, about things that are handwritten. And what you might not realize is that there have been different styles of writing in the Greek language over the years. And one is called uncial, and the other is called cursive. Cursive, when you look in a Greek interlinear, for example, and you see the little squiggly Greek alphabet, it looks like it's written in cursive. And that's basically what it looks like. You're using the small letters, and they're sometimes on a slant, and it's just the look of it, the style of it, that is why it's called cursive. I want you to recognize and know that, because this is something that was new to me, I was under the impression that it was the uncial style was the style in the day of Christ, and cursive came along later. And that's not so. Actually, both the uncial style of writing and cursive, both was utilized during the time of Christ. In other words, people wrote with all capital letters, and they also wrote with little letters in the time of Christ. Both of them were done. The cursive was an informal style of writing, whereas the uncial methodology was what was used for formal things. Very much like the Latins. When you look at the Latin inscriptions on the temples and those kinds of things in Rome and all the excavations, everything is in capital letters, and it's kind of hard to... Well, the uncial writing that we have, I want you to just think about this. If you were to just kind of arbitrarily say, okay, we're going to have 25 letters per line, we're going to have all the letters capitalized, and whenever you get to the end of a line, whether it's the end of a word or not, you go to the next line. No spaces between the words, very little punctuation. And so the manuscripts that we have that are called unsealed manuscripts, and they're the most important ones because they are the oldest. Those are the ones that that are all caps, and they're written in that structure. So you could be in the middle of a word, and I mean, I'm not talking about where, like we do, where, okay, put a hyphen there because the hyphen belongs there because it's in between the syllables. I'm talking about if it's the name Paul and the P comes at the end of the line, well, the A-U-L is going to come on the next line, and that's the way it's structured. So it's if you try to read it in English, just do that sometime. Try to paragraph in that way and try to read it. It's somewhat confusing. But that's the way it was written at that time with regard to formal writing in most of the copies. In fact, all of the copies that we have before the 9th century are unsealed in style. Now, I want to make note of something, and that is that when we look at the New Testament, It was not uncommon, especially with regard to the Apostle Paul, for the things that Paul wrote not to be written by his hand, but rather dictated by him to another. I'll give you just a couple of examples. In Romans 16, in verse 22, and all of these, three of these come at the end of the letters. But, Paul's getting to the end of his letter, and he's sending greetings. And one of the verses, verse 22, is a greeting not from Paul, but Tertius. And so Tertius inserts, I, Tertius, who wrote this epistle, greet you in the Lord. Now, I don't doubt he had Paul's permission to write that little line in there, but the point is that Tertius was the one writing it down. So Paul was dictating to him. There is speculation when you talk about Paul's thorn in the flesh, that possibly his thorn in the flesh, I mean, I've heard things like he had a speech impediment. There are a lot of things, a hair lip, I've heard that. But one of the ideas is possibly he had something like Parkinson's. There is one reference in Galatians chapter 6 and verse 11 where the Apostle Paul, at the end of the letter to the Galatians, he says, "See with what large letters I have written in my own hand," as if he was making a final personal greeting, and he wrote with large letters in his own hand, which seemed to indicate possibly Paul had a difficult time in writing. And so there's a good chance that the things that he wrote were actually narrated, it's not called narrated, what's it called?
Dictated,
thank you. Dictated to someone else. And then there's a third example in 1 Peter chapter 5 concerning Peter, who writes, "By Silvanus, our faithful brother, as I consider him, I have written you." Briefly. Can't read my own writing. I was scribbling this in. So these are examples. And so there's a chance that the original autographs were written in cursive. But when copies were being made to be read in churches, and copies were being made to spread to other individuals, well, these are official writings. These are inspired writings. So the scribes, when they wrote them in the unsealed style, because that was considered the formal and the important way of writing at that particular time. So as a result of that, the groups of witnesses that we have that are most important are the unseals because of their age. And that's the only reason, because they're older. That's why they're most important. Most of the curses that we have are from the 9th century on. So we don't have much in regard to the earlier. So what those do is kind of confirm. You can actually, this is what criticism is. So you've got five unseals. Let's say five unseals. And there's one discrepancy. There's a contradiction between. And one unseal has one thing it says. And the other four, they say the same thing as one another, but they're different from one. Well, okay, so you got four over here that have the same thing, and you have one over there that's different. Well, that's a variant reading. And it's obvious in most of those cases. A lot of times it's just a misspelling, or it's a variant spelling, but it's obvious that there's a mistake made with that one. And we've got four copies over here that are all in agreement to show. And by the way, it's a lot more than four. It's much larger than that. Okay, but says, yeah, but there are a lot of curses back in the, in the 12 and 1300s that say that too. Well, why would that be? Well, because they were copies of that mistake. You see what I'm saying? And so you can actually go and you can say, okay, well, this person says this, but we know why this person says it, because it's from this family of writings. This is from this particular uncial. And that's called the lower criticism. And the interesting thing about that is that when you begin to work through all of this, yes, there are some discrepancies. There are some differences in the various, lots of them actually. Usually variant readings, usually minor things. But because we have such a strong witness, we have so many examples, we can, with very few exceptions, very easily pick out which one's the wrong one, which one's the mistake, and which one is the right reading to ensure that we have the accurate text. It's really an interesting thing when you look at the way the arithmetic works in that, and that's why I have that last paragraph that I wanted to add. So looking at the bottom of the New Testament text page, the first page, bottom of the first page, over 5,300 manuscript copies exist of the New Testament. Now, we're not saying we've got 5,300 copies of the New Testament written in uncial or cursive. That's not what we're saying, because very few of them. You think about it. You take the time, if you want to do this, you handwrite. You get the New Testament, and you write in longhand the entire New Testament. And you put it in how many ever three-ring binders it takes, and you put it on your arm, and you carry it back and forth with you to church. And have that to be your copy of the Bible or the copy of the New Testament. Well, that's really not very workable. And in reality, what happened was that the manuscripts generally fall into four categories. People would have a set of or make a copy of the Gospels. So there are a lot of the Greek manuscripts that consist of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. There are a lot of the manuscripts that consist of the book of Acts and the general epistles, the ones that were written by Paul. There are a lot of them that are basically a collection of Paul's epistles. And then it's not uncommon to see just the book of Revelation by itself. Now, we kind of categorize them that way pretty much as well, just ourselves. And so it's not surprising that those kinds of categories and distinction would arise with regard to the various copies that we have. Okay? So turn it over to the page, and we'll kind of get through this the rest of it fairly quickly. First major point, about 650 of the uncials are known to exist. And these are the most important ones. So I that wasn't very clear. It's not the important uncials. There are about 650 uncial manuscripts, and these are the important manuscripts, or the most important manuscripts with regard to determine accuracy. About 95 of them are made up of papyrus. And some of those actually date from between the 2nd and 4th century. Very early. If you think about the end of the first century, it was when the canon came to a close. There are about 270 lectionaries. Some of the lectionaries are in... actually, there are a lot more than 270 lectionaries, but there are 270 written in the uncial form, the older lectionaries. Now, the lectionaries are kind of important because this is going to be... A lectionary is a copy that's going to be read in the church or be read in public. So we want to make sure that we get an accurate copy if we're going to be reading it in church. And so the lectionaries, that style, and those codices and other things, they are very well regarded often. And then there are 280 that are parchment. And when we're talking about parchment, we're talking about leather. Either leather or treated leather. Well, treated leather of some kind. If it's very nice leather, it's called vellum. And the three most important uncial manuscripts, and these are the ones you've heard of before, the Vatican, the Sinaitic, and the Alexandrian codices or codexes. These are the three most important ones because of their age. They all were written between before the fourth. I try how we say the fourth and the fifth century. So between 300 and 450 AD is when those copies were made, and they're made of vellum. And one of them, I believe it is the Sinaitic, is actually very beautiful as well. It's artistically done, very pretty writing, that kind of stuff. So I'm going to just read through very quickly the little sidebars with regard to these three manuscripts, because there's some interest in these things. Now, the Vatican manuscript, again, is the one that the Catholic Church controlled, and it was in Rome, we know there's evidence of it being in Rome since 1481, but the Catholic Church severely limited access until the mid-1800s. It was to the point to where when they did allow a scholar to go in who wanted to see, he could go in, but he had to be searched first, so that there wasn't any writing instruments or ability. And the monks would be looking over his shoulder, and if he spent too much time on one particular verse, which would be indicating he was memorizing it, they would make him turn the page. And he was only given access for just an hour or two, just to basically say, see, it does exist, we do have it, now leave. And that's kind of the way they treated the situation up until the mid-1800s. Well, finally, they allowed a few scholars in the mid-1800s to look at it a little bit more, and more interest came as a result of it. And finally, they basically created their own copy of it themselves in 1890 and published that. Okay. Now, it does not have all of the New Testament, but it has most of it. It's missing Hebrews after chapter 9 and verse 14. It does not contain 1 and 2 Timothy, Titus, or Revelation. Another interesting thing about the Vatican is that it doesn't contain Mark chapter 9, chapter 16, verses 9 through 20. New American Standard Version of the Bible, if you have that, it doesn't contain it, or if it does, it's in footnote. I can't remember the form. But it doesn't contain it, but it has a blank space on the page that is sufficiently large to include it. And the speculation is the scribe got to that point, and that passage, it has been in somewhat in dispute over the centuries as to whether it should be included or not, and he didn't know whether he should or not, so he left it empty, maybe thinking he'd go back later and add it if he should, and it never happened. So it's kind of an interesting thing in that regard. It's made of vellum, about 760 pages, 10 inches square. And it's considered the most exact copy of the New Testament, though it's not complete. Okay? Any questions about the Vatican? Second one of the three is the Sinaitic manuscript, which was a very interesting with regard to its discovery. It was discovered by Constantine von Tischendorf, who was a very young man, a very brilliant man, and a very arrogant young man, from what I've been told in the writings. But he is a very important individual with regard to this because of his abilities. He translated some manuscripts that were so faint that no one else could do it. But he had good eyesight, and he was patient, and he went through and made some translations. Well, he happened to go to, he decided to make it his life work to find as many manuscripts as he could to get an accurate New Testament. In 1844, he went to Mount Sinai at St. Catherine's Monastery, and he found copies of this. Now, I want to read to you his own representation of this when he got there. He said, "I was at the foot of Mount Sinai in the convent of St. Catherine, and I discovered the pearl of all my researches. In visiting the library of the monastery in the month of May in 1844, I perceived in the middle of the great hall a large and wide basket full of old parchments. And the librarian, who was a man of information, told me that two heaps of papers like these, moldered by time, had already been committed to the flames. My surprise was to find amid this heap of papers a considerable number of sheets of a copy of the Old Testament in Greek, which seemed to be one of the most ancient I'd ever seen. The authorities of the convent allowed me to possess myself of a third of these parchments, about 43 sheets, all the more readily as they were destined for the fire." So he told them, this is important, don't get rid of it. And they made him leave. And he came back 15 years later, couldn't find anything. Couldn't find any copies anywhere. And thought it had all been lost and burned. But more research was done, and finally, 15 years later, they found the remainder of the manuscript, and through a period of time, he was actually able to publish it, a copy of that. So it's about 730 leaves, but only about 400 remain. The New Testament is complete. About 15-inch square vellum sheets. And that's the oldest of the three as far as when it was written. They can tell by the style of writing and some other internal things to it. The third is the Alexandrian manuscript. It was known to be in Alexandria for several centuries. That's why it's called the Alexandrian Manuscript. Now it's in the British Museum. An interesting story about this: in 1731, there was a big fire in the museum, and the librarian, realizing the importance of that manuscript, he, in his nightgown, grabbed it and ran out the building wearing his, they said, his nightgown and his great wig. I don't know what a great wig is, but that's what he was carrying. And some of the New Testament of it is missing. It's not quite as old as the Vatican or Sinaitic. But these are the three most important. There are other manuscripts. The Codex of Ephraim is an important one. There's an interesting story regarding it, too. We don't have time to get into the Codex Bizet, which contains the Gospels, the Book of Acts, and a few other fragments. And so there are some important things, but these are the three big ones. And all of the newer translations, not the King James and New King James, but the ones that have come about since the mid-1800s, all of them refer to the Vatican, Sinaitic, and Alexandria manuscript as the primary sources for the English translations that we have. The King James, of course, none of these three had been discovered back then, and so the things that it used was not as recent. Okay, I mean, not as ancient; it were more recent copies. Okay, so that's I've shot it all. That's all I've got, other than the conclusion. And I just want—I'm not going to read the entirety of this, but it's an interesting. I've seen a number of these writings. I understand that the New Testament is held up to a higher standard, and rightfully so, because we claim inspiration for it. But it is an interesting thing that modernists and skeptics cast aspersion on the concept that it could be an accurate copy of the originals, when they do not do the same with regard to any other type of ancient literature. The ancient Greek literatures and ancient histories that scholars refer to, where they say these things are authoritative, and this, and we know this about the culture because of what is said by this particular historian. So what this particular two paragraphs, it consists of a quote from F.F. Bruce that he wrote in 1960. And it compares the 5,300 manuscripts of the New Testament that we have with some other examples. And one of the other comments, and I'll let you read that on your own, but just say this, that the evidence is extremely more authoritative and sure and strong for the New Testament than any other ancient document, period. Without any, it's not even a close comparison. And they talk about, because of the evidence that we have, the entirety of any significant questions concerning the New Testament text could be contained on a half page of paper with regard to the Greek text, as far as any serious disagreement. And none of those I have anything to do with any substantial matter of doctrine or teaching in Scripture. In contrast, Shakespeare, who lived in the 1500s, there are very strong arguments and disputes with regard to numerous passages as to which one is accurate and which one is right, because there's just not nearly as many witnesses. There's not as much evidence concerning what he actually wrote, and which version that we have is the one he actually wrote and which one's not. So there's some really strong things with regard to this. And when you look at this particular paragraph, you're going to find examples. We've got the history of Tacitus. Well, there are 4.5 copies that survive. And you know, they may say, well, you know, they're of his Book of Annals, the 16 books, there are 10 that survive in full and 2 in part. And not many copies of each, and that kind of thing. Whereas the New Testament is much, much stronger. So what I want you to get from this is we can trust that the text of the New Testament especially, I think both, the text of the New Testament especially, there is plenty of material out there. And the methodology exists to where we can be sure that the copies that we have contain what it was that was originally written in the manuscripts. We'll talk about criticism a little bit in the next lesson or lesson in the future. Yes?
I'll try to make this quick. I think it's important for us to make a quick observation on why it was so important that God has not allowed to cause variations in these 5,300 manuscripts. Let me ask you this. What problem would it cause critics, if God had preserved those 5,300 manuscripts perfectly, if there had been no variation at all those 5,300 fragments produced over many different centuries were identical. There would be no possible other explanation for that other than God miraculously did that. So God instead preserved faith and allow, if not plausible deniability, at least deniability on the part of the unbeliever. He put those variations in there. Does that make sense?
You've made that argument before in other areas as well, and I think there's some legitimacy. Whenever an individual has it in his mind that he does not want to serve God, God will give him the means of denial. And that's the nature of faith. It really is. And so that's a good point. We'll maybe talk about that a little bit later next time. Thank you all very much for your kind attention today.